Okay, another Q&A session. Okay, how do I use the teaching today about investigating the cause of suffering when working with betrayal? Been married to a high school sweetheart for 40 years, raised children together, and best of friends. Lately has gone off the deep end. Midlife crisis? Who knows, but he started drinking and acting out sexually. The feelings of shock, betrayal, hurt, anger, and fear are beyond words. If new relationship, I would leave, but he's been in my life since I was a child. Impossible to accept, but hard to leave. How do I find the cause of suffering, noble truth you spoke of today, and how to bring some equanimity and space around this? Yes, that's incredibly tough, because it touches on all sorts of layers betrayal and the sense of where is the responsibility, duty, all of it's, it is very complicated. But it's also, in the sense in terms of paying attention to suffering, that sense of one is recognizing that the suffering that one is experiencing is also in relationship to that sense of betrayal, but expectation of somebody else's conduct. And I think it's important to really make it clear for yourself one's own commitment to skillful conduct or skillful, wholesome conduct, and to be able to take a refuge in that, in the sense that, and that's where, say, like that recollection or reflection on equanimity is not just empty words, but is a sense of being owners of our karma, heir to our karma, and that recognizing that when somebody does unskillful action, then that is their action. And to be able to reflect on the sense of one's own commitment or one's own continuity of skillful action, so that one is, okay, I can look after myself, take responsibility for myself, and have at least a sense of clarity around that, so that there's a sense of not being too enmeshed in the and identifying with the actions of somebody else. Of course, after a marriage of 40 years, and it's the boundaries start to blur, so that one has made associations over time, so that very clear pulling back and realizing that what one's own actions are, in the sense of commitment to integrity and virtue and wholesome action, and to realize that that is a refuge, and then if somebody else, a spouse, a partner, if they start acting in ways that are you know, really unskillful, then one has to be able to make that separation and realize that they're going to have to inherit the results of their own actions, and that one is going to need to I think it's probably helpful to pull back a bit and to not get too entangled with somebody when somebody is exceedingly deluded. I mean, there's also by pulling back doesn't necessarily mean one has to cut oneself off completely, but because it's like pulling back and being able to see what the is there any effect? Is there any change? Is there any hope? And is there some other cause? Is it just some delusional fantasy or confusion in the person's life? Is it something that is brought on by something deeper, either physical or mental? So that really being able to step back to determine that. But it's hard to determine that if one's enmeshed. But yeah, it's not at all easy or straightforward, or that one can just give some kind of trite answer to. So. But I think that's also another thing of in terms of having a network of good spiritual friendships where one can draw close to other people who are who do have a good moral anchor and they're supportive of your practice, and that's where a network or having that contact of good kalyanamitta, because support is so important in situations like that. Having some kind of support, having some kind of sounding board that one can work through and talk honestly about the what one's experiencing. Okay, this has a different flavor. How does a stream enterer know on their next life that she or he is a stream enterer? It's actually really interesting because the 2,500 years of Buddhist history and Buddhist literature, I've never read anything that actually talks about that or explains it. It's a really interesting question, and I don't know why it's never been speculated on or proliferated about or something, but I've never come across anything that explains it or talks about it. So, I'd like to know.
Ajahn talked about it.
Huh?
Somebody asked Ajahn Dhan about that.
Yeah.
That same question.
Oh yeah, what do you say?
Said they remember at some point in their life.
Mm-mm.
They have the experience again.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes it's random or sometimes it's about
faith. He said somebody asked, there's a Thai monk, Ajahn Tan, and he was asked this same question, and he said a person would have a memory of that. Either it would be like a spontaneous memory or something that comes up in their life circumstance somehow, that there's a memory arises. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Can you talk about the quality of disgust and how it is beneficial for practice? For example, awareness of the disgusting nature of eating and the digestive process arises when I'm eating. And in all honesty, I try to finish my food as quickly as possible when this happens. Unpleasant. Is there a better, more skillful way to hold this experience? How is this beneficial beyond limiting overeating? I recognize it is an insight, but beyond this, do not understand how to work skillfully with it. Well, I think one of the things is just the word in the the Buddhist lexicon of disgust is how. Nibbida in Pali, Nibbida is translated, and it's actually a quality. This quality of Nibbida is quite far along in the process of insight and understanding, so that the basis of it there's a series of causal factors that comes up in many, many discourses about practice. The Buddha describes the development of a training and a practice and going through. There's many different starting points, wise reflection, faith, skillful action, but then it turns in with these various points as beginning points, and it's a, let's say, the cause and condition for the arising of delight, pamoja, and then with delight as the basis, as the cause and condition for the arising of piti, of rapture. With rapture as the cause and condition for the arising of apasati, or tranquility, and settled quality. With pasati as the tranquility, as the cause and condition, there's the arising of happiness, of sukha. And then with happiness as the cause and condition is the arising of samadhi, of settled, stable, still mind, heart. And actually the Buddha, in many of the discourses, the Buddha stops and emphasizes the happy mind is easily concentrated. It tends to be, the opposite of how most of us approach it, in the sense that you know, there's a lot of our meditation and practices. You know, when I get my samadhi together, then I'm going to be happy. But it's, you know, how do you get our happiness together, so that the mind settles? Then with samadhi as a cause and condition, there's the arising of knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. With knowledge and vision of the way things truly are as cause and condition, there's the arising of nipitta. So that nipitta this is not your ordinary run-of-the-mill street level disgust. this is a whole different ball game, or a whole different way that it's held. And I think one of the ways of looking at it is looking at the root of the word, of why that's chosen as a and discussed gustatory eating, losing flavor. It's sort of like losing the flavor for when you're experiencing such clarity and well-being, then one loses the flavor for running around trying to gratify the mind through the mind, the heart, through a desire process. It's much more. It turns back from that, and it's not discussed in terms of being repelled or but it doesn't have the same flavor. It doesn't have the same doesn't grab the interest anymore. So that, you know, it's really helpful to look at that in terms of there's a, you know, and there are, you know, the aspects of the contemplation on eating and the digestive process. It's not very pretty. But it's also, if the normal way we use disgust tends to, it has, I mean, it has very, there's aversion at its root. Aversion and aversion is always, it's always an unwholesome mental state. It's always unskillful. So that something that is more in the line of when one is all, it's sort of like, you know, when one's already full, and then you put out whatever kind of delicious food, you just can't get the interest going. And so that it's kind of similar to that. So that one's lost the flavor for it. So in the same way, that sense of that quality of nipita, and this is probably another word that should really be brought into the Buddhist language as a Pali word, because it has way more nuance than we can muster in the English language. So that, you know, I think that sense of recognizing when there is a, whenever there's, you know, say your ordinary way of speaking about disgust, if it's, you know, it's really, you know, kind of aversive, repellent, pushing away, that's not necessarily a very skillful way of holding it. I'd say whatever has an unwholesome root has a certain element of suffering there. So that to be able to recognize that and even when we think of the Sailika Satipatthana, when the Buddha gives the contemplations on the body and its contemplations on the unattractive nature of the body, the image that the Buddha uses in the discourse is one of it's helpful to because the Buddha was incredibly skilled at coming up with similes, imagery, to try to illustrate the points he's making. And then when he's talking about that asubhagamatthana, contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body, the image that he gives, he said, is when he compares it to sealed bag of skin, but it compares it to a bag with hill rice and paddy rice and red rice and black rice and green beans and red beans and yellow beans and mung beans and different kinds of rice, different kinds of beans. So that, I mean, that's pretty neutral. Being able, and that's how one say, and that's how one looks. One looks at it, at this bag of different kinds of grains, and notices, okay, you know, there's red rice, there's hill rice, there's paddy rice. I mean, that's one isn't working oneself up into a frenzy of disgust. It's very cool and clear, there's a settled quality to it, and there's a coolness there, so that the contemplations are taking one to a buoyed up by delight and tranquility and joy and happiness and clarity. Then it takes one to a place of evenness, an even quality of clarity.
I think Bhikkhu Bodhi has gone back to his original translation of disenchantment.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Disenchantment, then to disgust, and then back to disenchantment.
He's gone back to disenchantment. Yeah, that's a better translation of disenchantment. Because it's sort of like, there's kind of an enchanted spell cast over the objects of our sense desires. It's really compelling. But then having that disenchantment, it's just this frees up the heart a lot. Okay, this is more of a comment. I just wanted to share my gratitude for Ajahn Kurun Dhammo, Ajahn Nyaniko, and for Debbie, in brackets, you too, Lumpa, for giving each day very needed and timely encouragements, sometimes immediately answering a question I had just posed to myself. It's like you are all just reading my mind / heart. Questions go deeper, and so do your reflections on Dhamma. Bow, Anjali. So, it's good to know that it's useful. And I think that's certainly why, I would say, this is billed as an Abhayagiri retreat rather than any sort of an Ajahnpasana retreat. It's an Abhayagiri retreat, and all of us have been practicing together. And be careful what's going on in your mind. Is there being this being monitored? Okay, there is a borderline between being fearful in a wholesome way and being aggressive. That's a question. Question mark. I can't say anything about Dhamma teachers, as I've never experienced high ajahns, but a few yoga teachers I studied with, in my opinion, were rather just exercising their power over the students. How to tell the difference between a teacher who genuinely means well to their students while acting fearfully from someone on a power trip? That can really only be seen over time. You have to individual circumstances are really not a trustworthy indication. It's really over time and their commitment to integrity, their commitment to compassion, and a generosity that is giving for the benefit of the students. And seeing that over time, and then personality-wise, their personality can manifest in ways that are depending. I mean, it can be very forceful or kind of fierce, or incredibly aloof. Because somebody might appear to be incredibly aloof and disinterested. I mean, a good example of that is Ajahn Liam, the abbot of Wat Bopong. Sort of on the surface, he looks incredibly disinterested in the human condition, and whatever sort of beings manifest there, sometimes extraordinarily just cool. But then you watch how he lives his life, and how he gives, and how he takes responsibility, and you see, oh, this is really different. And similarly for like Ajahn Chah, you have this. The popular image of this warm, friendly, grandfatherly figure, living with him was a bit different. I mean, he had standards, and if you didn't pay attention, then you knew about it. And know, he could be very, very forceful. But the bigger picture was this incredible compassion and I think of Ajahn Mahabua, who's probably one of the kind of like the Arahant of the age for the last. He just passed away a couple of years ago, and reputation as extremely fierce. Very demanding. And remember him being at Wat Nanachat, the international monastery, and being, as this is, I'd already come to America, and I remember hearing the audio of the questions and answers, and he was asked, you know, what is it that, you know, what is the mind of an enlightened being like? And he said, oh, only compassion. I was like, that was just the immediate response. Only compassion. So that, and that's the sort of thing, but personality, that's one of the things that personality of different beings, even if they're enlightened, their personality comes through. I think of the story of toward the end of the Buddha's life. Buddha's getting older, Sangha's quite big, there's a group of monks who have been living with Anuruddha. Anuruddha is the Buddha's cousin. He's also an enlightened disciple. He's also foremost in knowledge of the Devas Ananda comes and kind of complains to the Buddha and sort of said, you know, these monks living with Anuruddha, and they're making all sorts of trouble for the Sangha, and Anuruddha's not admonishing them. He's not saying anything to them, and the Buddha sort of said, When did Anuruddha ever say anything to anybody or get involved with anybody? He's always been the sort of the space cadet up with the Devas. I mean, we need to get somebody else out there to look after the sort of misbehaving monks. It's personality. It doesn't have the temperament, the personality. It seems that suffering in lives of many people, my own included, comes from feeling unworthy or unlovable. Would you have any thought on why do so many people feel that way, and what will help to let go of this feeling? This is particularly Western feeling, particularly America. Americans are really good at this, part of it is the, it's just speculation on my part, but a couple different things of the, the Christian conditioning is And how do you say, the particular Christian conditioning in this country lends itself to a puritanical view of oneself and one's relationship to the universe, to the world, and it's overseen by a punitive God, deity, these are simplifications, but it has a particular effect. And even if one grew up in a agnostic or even atheist family, it's in the cultural perspective. It's in the cultural mix. We swim in it, so the ability to very consciously very overtly apply the mind to say like this, loving kindness and really drawing it in to the heart, the sense of this is giving a certain respect and acknowledgement to oneself and to care for oneself. There's a lot of within a particular American culture, a very strong competitive and therefore comparing quality, and that has that that's I think that's a sort of inheritance of the from the early days of the founding of the nation. This incredible competitive drive, push to always gain, to get, to go ahead, to move. I heard somebody say that sort of for like in American culture, it's always been a movement. There's always a movement to the next thing, the next place, the next better situation. There's always been this movement to move and get something more, to get something better, and of course, in doing that, you're competing with others and struggling against others. It's an ongoing process. They were sort of comparing Americans to Canadians, and so, all that Canadians ever wanted to do was survive the winter. So, but those are those kind of they're very deep cultural perspectives and assumptions of a personhood, both in relationship to others, but then also in relationship to the Christian conditioning it's very powerful in the culture. Very good. It was such a joy to hear Kundebi give a Dhamma talk at the retreat along with monastics. You're a jewel. Actually, you all are. Triple gem. Okay. That's why she's here. perception, sanya, can be really can be very slippery. I experience it as a veil, a view, a filter, or lens that colors a situation. Traditional Buddhist teachings of tinted glasses and bowls of water is very helpful. However, if identification is strong, I won't see it. Sanya, the perception. Do you have suggestions for how to see through sanya? How to know when it is coloring my worldview? Well, see, the thing is that every mental state that we have has sanya. If you've got a mind, then you've got sanya. Feeling and perception are a part of the process of knowing, cognizing, interacting with the world around you. And so that and that's why the Buddha gives us something like the Four Noble Truths. So that you start seeing, okay, what's the effect of that? So then you can come back and see, well, how does perception work? How is it coloring? In and of itself, very difficult to tease apart, to sort of, and that's where the with the five khandhas, and particularly the mental khandhas, I think it's in the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. She's being asked questions about nature of mind and nature of practice, and saying that these are aspects of mind are conjoined; they are not disjoined. So that they aren't separate. They're by very nature they're conjoined. They function together. They work together. You can't sort of tease them apart into discrete. You can see them function in somewhat different ways, but they're still working together. So that's where using the mirror of the Four Noble Truths, then you start seeing. What's the effect? How does it work? What happens? Then we get a motivation to work with it, to skillfully bring into being the qualities that allow the mind to become more clear, more still, more happy, more peaceful, and to relinquish the qualities of mind that tend to cloud and disturb the mind and bring it to a place of suffering. And in that process, then we start to understand a bit more clearly how those things work together. Okay, John, what is the difference between directed thought and verbal fabrication? Thank you for showing us patience. Actually, verbal fabrication is vitakka and vijara. I mean, that's when the Buddha, again, it's in that same sutta, Majjhima 44, the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina giving teachings and explanations on. I mean, it comes up in other places as well, but that's understanding what are the say that when you say citta sankhara, then it's the citta sankhara are the or beginning. Okay, bodily sankhara, gaya sankhara, in and out breath, in and out breathing. It's sort of what is the basic necessity for the body to exist. Okay, breathing. If you don't have a breathing being, then you don't have to worry about that body. It's a and the citta sankhara, the mental fabrications, mental formations, are pointing to the vedana and sanya, feeling and perception. That's the basic building block. Now, obviously, then it goes on to, in the same way that you have more than breath, and you have the whole body, but that's your basic sort of necessity. The basic necessity for citta sankhara is the feeling and perception. And then for verbal fabrication, the vaji sankhara, that is vitaka and vichara. There's these mental movement of the mind that is so directed thought as vitaka. So that with that movement of thought, then there becomes speech, and you can probably, even though there's not a lot of external talking going amongst the retreatants, I'm sure there's some verbal fabrications happening even as we speak. Thank you very much for your very compassionate, clear, and useful teachings. Can you please talk a little bit about dependent origination so that we may put an end to the causes of suffering? Thank you again for your compassionate teachings and humor. We appreciate you and the rest of the Sangha. Let's see. Talking a little bit about dependent origination. I don't know if I'll put an end to the cause of suffering by talking. It's a big subject, but I think it's the easiest thing is to go back to the principles of what dependent origination are, in the sense that with these causes and conditions present, then this arises. When these causes and conditions are not present, then this ceases. So that's the fundamental principle. There are causes and conditions that bring about the arising of phenomena, whether it's mental or physical, internal or external, and similarly for the, and when those causes aren't there, then there be a cessation. So it's actually a quite simple or ordinary proposition, but of course it gets more complicated and. Complex. It's interesting when I was at university, I took a course in Eastern religions and philosophy, and there wasn't, in those days, there wasn't actual Buddhist courses. The professor who wasn't a Buddhist, he was actually a Christian missionary who lived in China for years and years. But then he It came up in some kind of discussion, tangential sort of saying, it was a bit, felt a bit overwhelmed by the Buddhist philosophy and particularly something like dependent origination. So I picked that as my term paper topic. Figuring that I might as well write about something he doesn't know about, so I can get a, if it sounds good, I'll get a good mark. That's the story of my scholastic career. one of the best descriptions of dependent origination, or not descriptions of approaches, is Ajahn Chah's sort of thing. It's always in the context of suffering and the end of suffering. And you're looking at those causal processes in terms of, suffering and the end of suffering. And, don't get too caught in the details, don't make it too complicated. And he said, it's like falling down from a tree. You're up in a tree, as you're falling down, you don't have to count the branches. You just have to know when you hit the bottom, it's going to hurt. So dependent origination. Don't get too entangled in the details. Pay attention to the processes and then where it's going. So suffering or the end of suffering. Okay. How can one investigate without getting the mind too active? I find that when I try to investigate or reflect, my mind gets so active that I find myself getting caught up in it. I think that's it's an important balance that we need to pay attention to, in the sense that investigating has many modes, but one of the results of the investigation should be an increased clarity and increased confidence, as opposed to stirring the mind up, creating more doubts or more complications, so that sometimes investigation, all that's necessary is just a directed attention, as opposed to picking it apart too much or trying to analyze too much, but just an attention that is looking from a particular perspective, say the perspective of is this dukkha, is this not, where is the end of dukkha? Okay, directing attention in a way that helps the mind to have a certain energy, a certain clarity, and then it starts to see things more clearly. What you're paying attention to processes, just like that causal process. You're paying attention to the process as opposed to all the nitty gritty of the every single nuance of detail. Paying attention to the process of impermanence, of change, of uncertainty, that paying attention to that process, paying attention to the process of dukkha. What's the nuance of dukkha? Is it mildly dissatisfying? Is it wildly disagreeable? It's paying attention to the process. How does it work? Okay. Are the teachings being recorded? There is an attempt to record. It's supposed to be recorded. And then what happened to the usual football game? It's true. It's last year was, last year and this year, we haven't had the football games. It's been great. It enhances the quality of meditation. Okay. Now this is a comment to say thank you to the whole Sangha, really, for your interest in practice, meaning everybody. We were doing working meditation, and there was such a contrast with cars driving through and walking practice. Usually I feel more alone in practice. It feels so good not to be the odd one out. You guys almost made me cry with sweeping the walking paths yesterday. Thank you, Sangha. That's really, it's true. That's, I think that's the, the function of community, of Sangha, of Kalyanamitta, is that sense of support and sharing the path of practice. I once heard a Tibetan teacher say the Dharma is one. Can Dhamma mean phenomena in general, or am I misunderstanding? There's actually about three distinct meanings of Dhamma and Dharma. Dharma is Sanskrit, Dhamma is Pali. Say Dhamma as the teachings, Dhamma as principles of truth, and then Dhamma as phenomena, so that it is used in different ways, and sometimes there's no clear distinction. It's the context that it's used in that allows one to recognize how it's being used. My body does not physically handle sitting or stationary positions for long periods of time. I would like to do more walking meditation. Walking has a lot more distractions. Can you give some specifics on where to put my focus, rise and fall of breath, feet, skeleton moving, where to look, etc.? Is it possible to achieve the same level of calmness, concentration and insights when the body is moving and you cannot close eyes or keep focus on one spot? A lot of it is what feels helpful, so that in terms of a focus, personally I just tend to come down to the sensation of touch at the feet, and keep myself grounded in that the physical sensation of touch. In doing that, it's not too rigid a focus, so that then there's also a feeling of the movement of the body, of the feet, so that it's sort of bringing attention down into the lower extremities of the body. But I think I mentioned it also where I've also done walking meditation in conjunction with the breath, so that there's using the breath, so walking quite slowly and then on the in-breath, lifting of the foot, on the out-breath, setting it down. Walking quite slowly, breath is quite distinct, and moving is distinct. One could be doing walking meditation and just staying with the breath itself. One could be using, and I know that in Thailand, many of the monks will do walking meditation using that mantra Buddho, so that it's more of an inner recitation as they're walking. And you know, one can be doing the contemplations of the body, the skeleton moving, you know, so that there's, in terms of where to look, really keeping the eyes downcast, and be about 5-6 feet in front of one, just in front of one enough so that one can see where one's going, it's a clear path, but not sort of looking around. And then also making sure that the walking path is prescribed in the sense that you've got a clear beginning and end of the path. It's not sort of indistinct sort of wandering. Sort of it's a walking path that is quite clear and even. And certainly when the Buddha, there's a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha talks of the benefits of walking meditation. And one of the benefits of walking meditation is the concentration that arises from the walking meditation is very stable. As one cultivates the walking meditation, and the mind becomes focused in that, there's a stability of that samadhi that carries through, very, very solid. So that's a prerequisite for insight and understanding. The insights that would come from that would be that's not just because one is actually physically moving doesn't mean that one can't have insights into the Dhamma, because it's the same truth, it's the same reality, and sometimes there's a because there is a physical movement, the mind has enough movement in it or flexibility in it that there's a natural reflectiveness that takes place. That happens also. Because, I mean, I've certainly had insights in when doing walking meditation, I've had insight doing sitting meditation. So it's not a lot of it is what is one's own ability to take an interest in that practice itself. Okay. Was the fire sermon a quote-unquote teaching moment of hyperbole? I love to take photographs, for example, and it helps me engage much more deeply with the world outside my skull, and it fills me with rapture, compassion, and joy. Does the Buddha's recipe for liberation truly entail cutting off this experience of beauty? Where is the Theravada equivalent of the Zen suchness? The awe of life and its ephemerality. Thank you. And the fire sermon came at a point in the Buddha's teaching where he was, I mean, there really was a lot of monks there. But they were actual fire worshippers, as ascetics, and so that of course, you know, what ends up being passed on is fairly distilled, but the that flavor, I think probably of the essence of the teaching, I think remains, and it was such a radical shift for them to reflect in that way, that it really was a catalyst for this very large group to realize the teachings, and not just kind of her hyperbole making a good story. you know, the flavor of the Buddha's teachings, and particularly in the Theravada, the flavor is one of dispassion, relinquishment, a letting go. Not because there isn't beauty or there isn't an appreciation of the world around, but because of the habitual tendencies of the mind to hang on to the bits that we like and try to get away from the things that we dislike, so that it's putting in a context where you see the expressions of appreciation and delight in beauty and the nature around is in the Theragata and the Therigata. Those are the verses of the elders of the monks and nuns at the time of the Buddha, and then it's their own expression of their either delight or awe at the experience of the world around them, or the Buddhist teachings, or different perspectives that come up, and those are an interesting way of seeing the Buddha's teachings in a slightly different light. Also, I mean, on a certain level, we I think of the monasteries in our tradition. I mean, they're all in incredibly beautiful places. It's kind of amazing, really. It just seems to happen. We end up in these very beautiful settings. I remember going to visit. I mean, there's the branch monasteries in England, and of course they're all very beautiful settings. England's very pretty, and you know, even a place like Amaravati, which is within an hour's drive around Amaravati, which is where Ajahn Amaro lives, there's just over 20 million people. Right, blink. But it's rural, it's countryside, rural countryside, very pretty. And Chithurst is incredible. But then I went to, that was when I was on, I was doing a year sabbatical in the Chithurst Forest. That was really beautiful. And then I went out to visit there's a small branch monastery in Devon, and Devon's in the west country of England. It's very lush there. You think, England in general is already lush and green, but then you go to Devon and it's just vibrant green. It's just so. And then the little monastery is a very old country farmhouse, and it's got the kutis, and it's very beautiful. And then beside it is it's on a slope of a hill, and then top of the hill is a common land. And so I went up there for a walk on the common land, and then sort of you crest over and you look down into another valley. And I remember, I'd always been sort of oohing and awing about how this was, and then get up, look across down into this next valley, and I just had to laugh. I said, "This is just absurdly beautiful." I've wondered for some time how to put together A, birth, aging, and death are dukkha, and B, the cause of dukkha is craving. Is it correct to say that the source of dukkha is in the mind, that is, in craving? If so, what does it mean to say that birth, aging, and death, facts we don't control and can't change, are dukkha? Thank you for your generosity and wisdom. There's different, time scales that you look at the experience of, the human experience. So that when we're looking at birth, aging, and death as dukkha, one is just seeing this process of a human body, and also reflecting on this sense of dukkha being being very nuanced as a meaning. It isn't in that sense of this is unsatisfactory, it's fraught, it's stressful. All the aspects of our human life, because of their uncertainty and the ways with which we relate to them, and particularly with the different forms of craving, of wanting it to be this way, wanting it to be another way, wanting something else, all of that keeps a certain turmoil going, and that's dukkha. The source of dukkha is certainly in the mind and in craving, but it's also it's not abstracted. It's always in relation to things around us, and what's around us is this manifestation of these different phases of our human existence. Okay. I was very fortunate to receive a Pali name from the Sangha. At first, I was very energized in my practice, but then I saw it's just another identity to work with, particularly on pride and self-view sides. I seldom use my Pali name these days, but yet I realize that I'm neglecting this gift. How do I use my Pali name skillfully in my practice? Sorry, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Well, the nice thing about the Pali names is they usually have a good meaning, in the sense that they're chosen as having some kind of something to aspire to or something to manifest. You never get. I was thinking in Thai culture, especially in northeastern Thai. I don't know if they do it in central Thailand, but in northeastern Thailand, if for some reason there's some fear or concern about a child, and I don't know if they do it even this in modern era, but sometimes they'll give the, if there's some sort of concern or there was a difficult birth or some feeling of some problem for the child, then they'll give the child a really awful name. That's like one of the senior monks of in the Ajahn Chah Sangha is sort of Ajahn Ugly Dog. Ajahn Mahasang. So we don't do that in Pali. we give the names are something to live up to, something to some real wholesome quality, and so that they're helpful reminders to give ourselves an opportunity to step out of our assumed identity and our assumed history, and to put attention on something that is more useful, beneficial, positive, and it's just a tool so that just because you've got another name doesn't mean you've actually really become another person, but it's like a seed that we can plant for ourselves. So to use it skillfully is just kind of reminding ourselves of the theme of embodying a quality or a virtue. So my own name, Pasano, is one having faith, one having joy. So it was always something to sort of try to encourage myself with. Ajahn Kurun Dhammo is one with the dhammas of compassion. Jnaniko is knowledge, is it? Jnaniko, one with knowledge, wisdom. Kastapo is a historical name of one of the great disciples in the time of the Buddha, so that it's like the so yeah yeah we don't the Ajahn Sumedho used to sometimes come up with these outrageous names and threaten people that's who he was going to name them. Pity Poopo. Which so you can, it's a tool that one can use skillfully, having a name to remind ourselves of our possibility. Was Pali ever a conversational language? Do you know of a translation of suttas that uses more common everyday words? For example, saying letting go or releasing instead of relinquishing. I like to use simple words in the day to remind myself. Pali was it was more of the vernacular, a local dialect that was spoken at the time of the Buddha. Or used in one of the areas around in northern India, and Sanskrit has always been sort of the religious language, Sanskrit's never been a spoken language. Sanskrit is specifically reserved for literature and particularly spiritual religious discourse and teachings. I haven't seen a translation of recent translations of suttas using very common everyday language. There was a book around when I lived in Thailand, and it was probably compiled or translated maybe mid-70s to late-70s. And I don't remember the name of the author. And it's a collection of probably 10 or 12 discourses that the person had put into a more of like a conversational tone or very simple language. And I've never seen any compilations like that again. So that I'm sure one can do a Google search and find it somewhere. It's also why I say, like using language. Oftentimes, I use several different words. Say for myself as I'm talking and teaching, because trying to get a flavor. Or trying to convey a feeling for the meanings of things. And even the Buddha himself would do that in the Pali language, using a variety of words to express an idea or a perspective. Because I think that, so in the time of the Buddha would be teaching people from many different backgrounds and many different languages. He himself, say, where he lived and taught was a different region than from where he grew up. He was familiar with many of the different dialects and many of his students and disciples would have different backgrounds, especially in terms of India, within the caste system, so they'd have a different kind of basically education and background. But then they would also have people from different regions, and they'd be used to different dialects, so that they would, in expressing the Buddha, expressing his teachings, trying to cover the bases and make sure that people understand the flavor of what he is teaching.